You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. While the fighting in Iraq winds down, the attacks on civil liberties continue here at home. Nationwide, 162 cities, large and small, have passed anti-war resolutions, and seven cities have passed resolutions intended to defend the rights of the civil rights of their citizens from the perceived threats of the USA Patriot Act or the Homeland Security Act and related legislation. In this climate of growing opposition, Arcata, California, has taken its existing resolution a step further. Casey Connor, reporting for Pacifica affiliate KMUD in Northern California, has more in this report.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes.
The city of Arcata became the first city in the nation to pass a municipal ordinance instructing the heads of the city departments to refuse cooperation with any requests of federal agents that violate the Bill of Rights or the 14th Amendment. Such requests may be for aid in detention or questioning of individuals, for information, or other assistance. The ordinance also declares that no management employees shall voluntarily participate in unconstitutional detentions or profiling of any kind. If a management employee deems a federal request unconstitutional, they will report the request to the city manager, who will bring the issue before the city council. Opponents say that as a symbolic gesture, this ordinance places undue burden on the employees of the city who may face legal repercussions as a result of their non-cooperation, or that it may even make Arcata more inviting to terrorists. Supporters note that the department heads have all signed a letter endorsing the ordinance, and that to the extent that their requests under the various federal laws are constitutional, the ordinance does nothing. Supporters also note that the ordinance directs the city to provide legal defense to any management employee criminally charged for their refusal, and that in such circumstances, civil rights organizations such as the ACLU would probably offer their legal support.
I think this is, in effect, an act of civil disobedience. What we are saying as a city, and what I'm saying in particular, is that we live in a time of emergency. We live in a time when the federal government is assuming powers which it has no right to assume under our laws and under our Constitution.
City Council member David Meserve was a principal author of the ordinance.
I'd say the outcome of both the town hall meeting and the major comment period at the City Council meeting both ran about 90 to 95% in favor of it.
However, this area of Northern California is known for tension between self-described environmental and community activists and self-described supporters of logging families or traditional values. This ordinance was passed in a context where use of the term eco-terrorist inspires great controversy. Some critics see this ordinance as veiled protection of local activists from federal investigators. The strongly worded resolution in response to the USA Patriot Act passed earlier by the city does cite inappropriate FBI surveillance of domestic groups.
This ordinance does not provide protection from any valid law enforcement procedure.
The legislation, titled An Ordinance of the City Council of Arcata Amending the Arcata Municipal Code to Defend the Bill of Rights and Civil Liberties, applies only to management employees such as the city manager, the police chief, the directors of environmental services, public works, community development, and finance. It intends to ensure that local law enforcement will uphold the constitutional rights of the citizens, quote, even if requested or authorized to infringe upon such rights by federal or state law enforcement agencies acting under new powers created by the USA Patriot Act, Homeland Security Act, related executive orders, regulations, or future enacted laws, executive orders, or regulations. Arcata law enforcement is somewhat accustomed to the conflict between state and federal law regarding the hotly debated issue of medical marijuana use, but this ordinance may present new challenges. Randall Mendoza, Arcata Chief of Police, does not believe so.
Sure. I appreciate the council's support on that issue, but I want to make it clear that I would never, in all the years that I've been a law enforcement officer, I would never tolerate being put in a position to violate somebody's constitutional rights. So this is just frosting on the cake for me.
Nancy Diamond is the Arcata City Attorney.
Because the ordinance is really a statement of upholding the 14th Amendment and the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution, that no management employee is going to be put at a great level of risk or exposure.
Most city officials note that the federal agencies are highly unlikely to involve local departments in their efforts. Officials say that a recent federal drug enforcement agency bus that shut down local glassblowing operations accused of selling drug paraphernalia illegally was as much a surprise to local law enforcement as it was local citizens. Officials also note that the city does not maintain much in the way of data that would be useful to federal investigators. None expect dramatic consequences as a result of the ordinance, but most feel that it was important all the same. Arcata Mayor Bob Ornelas.
People have been saying, it can't happen here, it can't happen here, but fascism has reared its ugly head in the U.S. The overwhelming majority of the people in Arcata would support making a statement that this does, that the Patriot Act has just gone too far.
U.S. Department of Justice spokesperson Mark Corallo.
There's nothing in the Patriot Act that's unconstitutional. The fact that certain cities would instruct law enforcement, local law enforcement, to not cooperate with federal law, with federal law enforcement in our attempts and our efforts to protect the American people from terrorist attacks is somewhat discouraging.
In recent months, Arcata has also passed a resolution in defense of international law in order to criticize military action in Afghanistan, and, regarding Iraq, a resolution to oppose any strike, to support diplomatic solutions, and to urge U.S. officials to pursue less energy-dependent policies.
That was Casey Connor reporting for Pacifica affiliate KMUD in Northern California. Special thanks also to Simon Fresh and Joellen Clark-Peterson for production assistance with that report. Today on Peace Watch, we're introducing the first part of a 10-part special series called A Clear and Present Danger, which will explore the challenges of free expression in an open society. Today, host Stephen Rohde speaks with investigative reporter Greg Pallast on the effects embedding journalists with the military has had on the freedom of expression during the war and now the post-war coverage in Iraq.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger. We're with Greg Pallast, who's award-winning and really extraordinary book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, is now out in paperback, reaching more people than ever. Greg, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Steve, it's great to be back.
I want to talk about two things today, one foreign, one domestic. What has been the consequence of reporting and freedom of expression in terms of our embedded journalists in Iraq and now the post-war coverage of Iraq?
Well, two things. I mean, the coverage of the war in Iraq was just absolutely horrendous in the sense of the idea of the embedded reporter. That means that you're looking at the American people when they were told by CNN and Fox, you're seeing the whole war. What you're doing is you're watching the Iraqi people through the gun hole of a moving tank. You know, and one of the most amazing things, you know, is that, you know, BBC, we're not allowed to be in bed with anyone. I'm a BBC television reporter. I also write for The Guardian out of Britain. One basic rule, if you're going to go to an Arabic-speaking nation, you have to speak Arabic so you can talk to the people we're supposedly liberating and find out if they're, you know, we were told they were going to throw flowers at us, and at first they started throwing exploding flowers at us. And we would have known that if our reporters had simply asked them in their language, you know, instead of hanging out in the tanks and you know, showing us great films of all the weird little gadgets and toy planes and Star Wars Game Boy equipment. That's how our war was. Most Iraqis that we knew, pretty much universally, you had the sentiment that people there despise Saddam Hussein. You remember our shock and awe campaign. So far, the shock and awe seems to be that we got a lot of Iraqis in the streets saying, get the heck out of our country. And suddenly we're very nervous, and suddenly we're starting to talk about needing to occupy these people because they can't handle democracy. So it's a new kind of red baiting. It's kind of Saddam baiting, that if you don't go along with invasions, conquests, and takeovers of foreign nations, that you are suddenly in love with a dictator. Obviously, it's more than offensive. Like I say, it's a new red baiting. It's dangerous. And people who are targeted in that manner are, of course, kept off the air. So the idea, the whole discussion, which was completely wrong, which was, are these guys censored who are in the tanks? It doesn't matter. Not only are the generals pointing the guns, but they're in effect pointing the cameras. They're telling you what to shoot, with not only with the gun, but with the camera, and where to look. And you're not going to get out of that tank wearing a U.S. uniform and walk among the people and say, I'm neutral, and see if you can get an opinion from them. I mean, the idea is like it mad and absurd.
What news, what information did people in England and around the world get that Americans were not getting through these embedded journalists?
Very simple story that no doubt whenever we could, you know, get Iraqis off the side and keep them nameless, you couldn't find anyone that supported Saddam Hussein. You also couldn't find anyone that supported American conquest or British conquest, too. Especially the Brits really took the bullets, because as they entered Basra, what people said, This is the third. This is the third invasion in the last 50 years or 60 years by the British of Basra. So they were not met with flowers, and at least the British troops had an idea that that was going to happen because the press had infiltrated in without and weren't embedded with the troops, but were embedded in with the people.
There's been recent scholarship of the emerging national security state. When you look at the factors that go into the creation of a national security state, the United States is dangerously moving in that direction in terms of surveillance and restrictions on privacy and the rest. But what I'm interested in today is the element of the media in service of the state. From your observations, how is American media in service of state policy here?
Well, it's just absolutely stunning. Actually, don't take my word for it. I had a guy on my program, Newsnight, BBC, another reporter was talking to him named Dan Rather. And Rather said on my program, he said, I know I should be asking tough questions, but I'm not going to ask tough questions because if I do, I'm going to be lynched, to use the term necklace. In other words, a burning tire was going to be put around his neck as unpatriotic. That's what he said to a London audience. In America, he got on television and said, George W. Bush is my commander-in-chief, and he should tell me where to line up. Well, I don't think that reporters should get in line, and I don't think reporters – and when a Dan Rather is, you know, shaking in his boots about asking a tough question, then we're in bad shape. And even worse, it's being blessed. We had the head of the Harvard School of Journalism I watched on TV and another head of another journalism school, and they talked about how wonderful it was that, for example, troops are being embedded. And they used the term, they said, because now we can bond with the military. We, the journalists, can bond with the military. And after all, we're on the same team. You know, as if war were a team sport. You know, it's like as if we were out there and it was skins and shirts. You know, and this is these are the deans of the top journalism schools, you have to understand, that were saying this stuff on the air. And, of course, that means that anyone who suggests otherwise, you can imagine if you're a journalism student or a reporter trying to be independent, you've now been kicked in the teeth by the one crew that we thought would maybe like be a bit horrified by breaching the wall between the military apparatus and the state apparatus and journalism.
The history of the First Amendment, James Madison, I don't think, meant for the press to be bonded in service of the state. I don't read that in our First Amendment history. So that's a dangerous direction we're going in.
Well, I mean, it's a very dangerous. It's sad. It's a commercially dangerous direction because we have this really commercially poisoned news that's going on. I mean, you have to understand, it's not a minor or acute thing that a guy like Phil Donahue was knocked off. I feel kind of personally because part of that story was that I kept trying to he kept trying to suggest that I get on his program. He did it once in the middle of his pushing. He went to get me out to be a continuing commentator on the Bush administration. Not because my commentary is so brilliant, but the idea is that you're going to get information that is otherwise locked out of the U.S. press. And the internal memo from MSNBC did not talk about Phil's ratings, which were the top of the network's ratings. But their concept that it would be a nightmare if Phil kept putting on what they said, his guests, which are skeptical of the Bush administration. And that was the sin, because they replaced him with a lower-rated show. That means that there is a fear going through the media all the way from the executive suites on down. And part of this is this mad dash right now to grab spectrum and grab licenses. As long as the general's son, Colin Powell's son, has control of the FCC, we're going to see more kowtowing because they hold out those licenses and the breaking down of the rules allowing massive mergers. He's holding out these tremendous multi-billion dollar carrots to these media guys. And obviously, if they start dissenting, we know who's going to get the goodies.
I mean, let's underscore that. Today, the head of the Federal Communications Commission is the son of Colin Powell. I mean, people, I think, have to know that. It's a pretty obvious form of embedded journalism and control of our media if you are a family member of the Secretary of State.
Well, let's put it this way. If the current president is the son of the former chief of the CIA, so taking over the FCC is minor stuff at this point. So, yeah, no, we have the problem of a press which has forgot to ask questions, is afraid to ask questions. And now, for example, there's a discussion of what is being done under the Patriot Act. I mean, one of the things is we now see a massive international database being created, not only of Americans, but of foreigners by the U.S. government. Plus the new use, for example, you know, I did a story, of course, about how black people were removed from the voter rolls before the 2000 election. That was done by a company called Choice Point. Tens of thousands of black voters, 94,000 in the end, voters, mostly black, were removed from the voter rolls before the 2000 presidential election. That was what elected the president. The company that came up with that rotten little racist list was a company called Choice Point. And according to Forbes magazine, they are the winners of the war on terror, Choice Point, because they're getting all these contracts, including contracts that supply information on the citizens of other countries. And one little problem is that while doing it at the FBI's behest, non-bid contracts, remember, the Mexican government is now thinking of taking legal action because we may pride ourselves on our civil rights, but there's a couple of other governments which actually may enforce the privacy rights of their citizens. For the first time ever, the United States government is allowing itself the right to take away the rights of citizens to their privacy, to go into your files without a search warrant. They're using mechanisms called data mining out of the office of – it was called Total Information Awareness, which is, you know, creepy enough. They can't use that name anymore, but they're still doing the same game. Data mining – and the data is provided by this company, Choice Point, which has 16 billion records on every American, on all Americans, 16 billion records, and it's growing rapidly every minute. Before, that material was sacrosanct unless someone had a warrant saying they had probable cause to believe you had committed a crime. Now you don't have to commit a crime. Robotic search engines are going through, seeing if maybe you might think of possibly committing a crime one day.
Well, this brings us right back to home. We're spreading democracy in Iraq and abroad, but what's the state of democracy at home? You've broken the story that tens of thousands of people were purged from the voter lists in Florida. Voting machines were not working. We're approaching the 2004 election. What are the prospects of those kinds of things happening again?
Well, it's going to happen again unless we take action. This week marks the 40th anniversary of the March on Birmingham, and I'm going down. I've been asked by Martin Luther King III to join him on the march and discuss the fact that they're taking the Florida system of purging black voters and rolling it out nationwide under something called, horribly, the Martin Luther King Voting Reform Act of 2002. And he is angry that his daddy's name is being used to purge more black voters. They're going to take the Florida system and impose it everywhere, in part by requiring the computerization of voter rolls and allowing secretaries of state, 50 Catherine Harris's, to dip in and purge voters that they believe may be illegal voters. Now, voting illegally is a crime. So this is saying, well, we think you might be creating crime. We're not going to arrest you and have a trial. We're just going to take away your civil rights, because actually there's very few people who risk going to jail just to vote for the school board. But it is a cool mechanism for knocking out tens and now maybe hundreds of thousands of voters that you don't like. Pretty much you can tell the vote of a black voter. So the easiest way to fix a vote is to remove voters by race. And in a lot of states, race is right on the voter forms. So look out. I mean, this is, well, let's put it this way. There's just no shame. Instead of fixing the problem that happened in Florida, the disaster, in spite of the NAACP's lawsuits, there is still absolute not only resistance but arrogance to spread that system nationwide.
Now, Jeb Bush was reelected in Florida in 2002. What's the report card down there since the work you did revealed what happened?
Well, first brother Jeb, promised that he would return all these illegally scrubbed black voters to the voter rolls. But notably, they weren't returned. There was no move to return them till after Brother Jeb was reelected in what was originally a very close race.
What can we do about this when we scare each other and reveal what's happening domestically and overseas in terms of the reporting of information, the reporting of news, and then the consequences of it here at home? What are we going to do about this?
One, turn off the tube. Two, turn on Pacifica. Three, the First Amendment gives us the right to petition. And Martin Luther King III and Working Assets, I understand, are now going to try to put together a petition of a million names to say, no, you're not going to use Martin Luther King's name to take away the vote of black voters in America, because we're going to now have to redo the civil rights movement once again. We're going to have to march from Birmingham to Selma and reclaim the right to vote for black Americans.
Greg, it is always awe-inspiring, eye-opening, and a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
Steve, great to be here.
A Clear and Present Danger was hosted by civil liberties attorney Stephen Rohde, his guest investigative journalist Greg Pallast. This segment was a production of Penn Center USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives. The executive producer is Deborah Jones, and the engineer and editor is Mark Torres. For more information about Penn USA, log on to their website at www.pennusa.org. And tune in again next week on Pacifica's Peace Watch for part two of this series. Finally tonight, the Creative Unity Collective at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York presents this public service announcement from the President of the United States.
I like that music. Very exuberant. Post-Iraq victory. Booyah. Good evening, my fellow Americans. As you know, we've just completed the very successful first and second stages of our war in the Persian Gulf. The third stage, bringing the peace, well, we haven't exactly got that part worked out yet, but we're figuring out as we go along, and I'm just asking you to be patient with me. But just as certainly as we've taken Iraq off the map, we find new threats, things that are equally dangerous, places that reek with the self-same evil that Iraq did. I'm sure you're aware that I mentioned an axis of evil, where I cited places such as Iraq, Iran, and what was the other place? North Korea. But after close observation and many months of careful study and satellite photos and watching Nancy Grace do the Larry King show, it has come to my attention that there are other evil hotspots in this world. In fact, some of them practically on our own doorstep. Places that threaten the American way of life. Colin Powell has provided me with intelligence information culled from Weekly World News that very clearly states that we have a terrorist front in our own country. Apparently there's a place where women are simply not safe. I'm talking about Modesto, California. Apparently the still congressperson, Gary Condit from there, was involved in a bit of a brouhaha. Oh, let's just come out and say it, a flat-out murder. And has yet to been brought to charge for that. We know he did it. We know the weapons are there. All we have to do there is go and get him. But apparently, it's happened again. I'm talking about Scott Peterson and his lovely fly wife, Lacey Peterson, who he apparently killed for some skank. I saw the picture of the girlfriend, and I look at the picture of Lacey Peterson, and I can only go why. But that goes above and beyond the point. The point is that Modesto, California is an evil place. It's a place that is practically drenched in evil. And as you know, Modesto is in the same state where O.J. committed his crimes. All right? All right? So it's a big state. It may have been 800 miles away, but it's a connection. It's like Al-Qaeda and Iraq, O.J. and Modesto. I think you see the closeness here. And I'm asking Americans to give me the same support that they gave me in prosecuting the war in Iraq. I'm asking them to give me the same support for the coming war I'm going to prosecute in Modesto. As we speak, 275,000 troops, including National Guard units, are marching into Modesto. I know Modesto is only 100,000 people, and we're going to have to find a place for these people to bunk up. I don't know, maybe Fresno. But we're going in. We're going in. We've distributed playing cards with the faces of 55 really bad guys in Modesto, and we're going to bring them to justice. All right? These are the guys that have frequented the red light district. We're bringing them to justice. Now, some of you might ask, George, why are you doing this? Is it because of a need to stamp out evil? Is it because you feel morally obligated to take care of this wrongness? Or is it because the stock market plunged 133 points today and you're trying to duck the blame for that come Monday morning? How the hell did that get in the script? At any rate, we're just going to purge evil. Modesto, this shall not stand. I'm coming after you too, Utah, you bigamists. You know, I'm coming after Miami too, and you looters. And New York, with your squeegee men. Terror comes in all places, and I aim to rid it from every one of those spaces. Thank you.
the Creative Unity Collective at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Special thanks to T from the Pattersons Taking the Train to Tibet for preparing that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Christine Ahern at Pacifica affiliate WJFF, Aaron Glantz and Keith Chalgion. Thanks to Pete Karak at RadioForAll.net and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at PacificaArchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.